The emergence of in vitro fertilization in the late 70s and the early 80s, it was met, I think, by mixed responses within Christian circles. And these varied from, on the one hand, outright hostility amid fears that human life as we know it was threatened, to, on the other, guarded acceptance of the major procedures. And so there wasn't unanimity. And there continue, I think, to be a multitude of voices advocating for a whole range of responses. In May 2013, a baby was born from an embryo that had been assessed with next-generation sequencing. This was carried out to check the embryos for abnormal chromosomes. It followed a standard IVF treatment. 13 embryos were available. These were then cultured for 5 days, and a few cells were removed for NGS analysis. From this, it emerged that while most of the embryos looked healthy, only 3 had the correct number of chromosomes. One of these was transferred to the woman's uterus, and you can see the result in the picture. Now, this is very far removed from standard IVF, but I think it illustrates in a nice little way what is becoming possible. Now, I've had an intense interest in this whole realm of IVF since the 1970s, and actually I wrote my first article on it in 1974, and that was 4 years before the birth of the first baby, that is Louise Brown, who was born in 1978 in the UK. And I got interested in it because of the way in which I knew it would force us to look at how we deal with the human embryo. Because, of course, the embryo is the focus of all efforts at bringing about fertilization outside the body. And I realized then that this would prove crucial from a Christian angle. Because once the embryo can be seen and analyzed in the laboratory, it becomes amenable to scientific investigation. And of course, it didn't take too much insight to realize that many Christians would find these sorts of interventions somewhat difficult to accept. What I think, though, is surprising, though, is that the churches and most theologians had shown practically no interest whatsoever in the whole realm throughout the 1960s and the 1970s. And that, of course, was when all the essential scientific studies that resulted in IVF were actually taking place. I think it's also salutary to reflect that Robert Edwards, the reproductive physiologist who almost single-handedly brought these developments in human beings to fruition, he wrote extensively on the ethical repercussions of IVF as he saw them. He longed to debate with politicians, philosophers, theologians, and policymakers, but largely to no avail. This was because IVF lay in the future, and it was of very little interest compared with abortion and overpopulation. However, once the first IVF babies were born, all changed. It became clear that these children were largely healthy and weren't seriously malformed. Now, of course, nothing is ever quite this straightforward. But what emerged was that an unlikely technique became the hope of many infertile couples who are longing for a child of their own. In the UK, the 1984 Warner Committee of Inquiry, it set the path for UK legislation, and many of its recommendations, even though some of them were very contentious, they proved crucial for one debate after another, not only in the UK, but throughout the world. What I think is of interest is that the churches, at long last, woke up, and they realized that something dramatic had hit them, something for which they were very seriously ill-prepared. After all, they spent years arguing about abortion and the fetus, but now they had to contend with IVF and the very early embryo. And unfortunately, few had expertise in embryology. And they now came face to face with terms that they had probably never seen before: the blastocyst, the inner cell mass, the primitive streak. And of course, theologians were just as ignorant about embryology. And they were similarly perplexed when confronted with this very unfamiliar territory. But some of them had ready-made answers. The Vatican stance, as expressed in the 1987 instruction Donum Vitae, it condemned the voluntary destruction of human embryos that had been obtained in vitro for research purposes. It asserted that researchers are usurping the place of God simply because they are choosing which embryos will be allowed to live and which will be, in their words, sent to death. And again, to quote their words, defenseless human beings are being killed. IVF then was viewed negatively because it gave two biomedical scientists power over the life and the identity of embryos. And again, to quote, leading to the domination of technology over the origin and the destiny of the human person. In 2008, these positions were reiterated with a few minor amendments, and that was in the instruction Dignitas Personae. Writing in 1984, one eminent evangelical theologian concluded that when we start making human beings by the use of artificial means like IVF, we stop loving them. In other words, when human beings intrude in the reproductive process, they take the whole process out of the hands of God. The IVF child then becomes the child of, or the creature of, the doctors who, at least in part, were responsible for bringing him or her into existence. Also in 1984, another Protestant theologian concluded that modern reproductive technology represents a threat to the future of the human race. According to this writer, there is no room for any aspect of IVF, and no room for any experimentation on embryos, nor for surrogate motherhood, nor indeed for any form of technological manipulation in this area. A few years later, in 2002, yet another evangelical theologian also expressed firm opposition to any technological inroads into the reproductive process, including every one of the artificial reproductive technologies, or the ARTs, and also artificial contraception. In this writer's view, the use of the ARTs forces God to accept the child when he hasn't given that gift of life. This is because, in his view, scientific technological reproduction has replaced divine-initiated procreation. And so, for him, the end result will be alterations in the fundamental essence of human nature. Now, numerous church bodies, from conservative Protestant to Roman Catholic, took an uncompromisingly negative view of the practice of IVF. The argument was that since embryos are inviolable from the time of fertilization, no embryo should ever be destroyed. This, of course, had happened in the development of IVF, and it continued to happen. And so, according to many bodies, there could be no place for IVF within a Christian ethical framework. Some also regarded IVF as an act of mastery, leading to the claim that the artificial production of children is dehumanizing. Now, of course, there were certainly alternative readings within the Christian community, but I've confined my attention to the strong opposition because I think it gives a feel for the hostile environment that characterized a wide swathe of Christian opinion from the 1980s onwards. And so that's the background. And so I think we have to just see how we might analyze what's going on. So this is what I want to start doing. So if one looks then at the literature from the 1980s onwards, it seems to me, in very simple terms, it falls into two clearly delineated responses to IVF. There is the negative, with its suspicion of IVF, and in some cases rejection of it. And there is the positive, with its stress on the needs of the infertile and openness to at least acceptance of IVF. The arguments of those who are negative towards IVF pay particular attention to protection of the embryo, whereas those who are positive place the emphasis far more on the needs of the infertile. So what I want to do now is to take this a bit further and to look at what I've called, these are my categories, I've subdivided into five categories. Category A is embryo-centered, what I call categorical. Now, there are many Christian voices that contend that human life commences at conception or fertilization, in the sense that human embryos are to be given full moral value from fertilization or day one of gestation. From this it follows that we are to ensure as far as we can that all embryos are protected, and under no circumstances should their lives be sacrificed for any end other than that of their own survival. The argument here is that as the weakest and most vulnerable of human beings, a Christian ethic will always seek to protect them. Now, if taken at face value, this stance clashes with the development of IVF and also with the ongoing clinical practice of IVF. It runs counter to a procedure that some regard as involving the killing of innocent human life. It also follows that this view of embryos will not allow one embryo to be selected over another, whether on the ground of satisfactory versus unsatisfactory cellular division, something that is employed routinely in fertility clinics, or on, let us say, genetic grounds, if you're looking, say, for the presence or absence of the gene for cystic fibrosis, as in pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Viewing all embryos as inviolable negates the production of excess numbers of embryos in IVF, because, of course, that opens the way to discarding, or if you like, killing some of these surplus embryos. Neither does it allow for the freezing of embryos. Now, I think this category, at least in its purest form, leads to only one conclusion, and that is that no technological intrusion in reproduction is acceptable because it's a deviation from God's creation pattern and purpose. The second category is again embryo-centered, is what I call precautionary. Now, in many ways, those in this category have very much in common with those in A, because their interests again concentrate on the protection of embryos. But rather than asserting that embryos are persons deserving of complete respect, protection, the claim here is that those who do not adhere to this position need to prove beyond any doubt that human embryos are not persons. And this is a precautionary stance. And I think it's epitomized by one writer in the title of one of his papers. To be willing to kill what for all one knows is a person is to be willing to kill a person. And I think this expresses the sentiment that we have an obligation to protect every embryo we encounter, including every embryo in the IVF clinic or the laboratory, until such time as there is compelling evidence to show that this viewpoint is incorrect. And I think when expressed in explicitly Christian terms, this states that it has to be proved that God does not confer a unique status and a unique destiny on every embryo. Category C, again embryo-centered, this is what I call human dominion. The underlying concern in this instance is that technological inroads into reproduction are fraught with danger because children are being made using technological processes. And this is the dangerous realm of what some people call artifice. The deep concern here is that of technological imperialism, which is, of course, a general concern. On this view, IVF is being equated with an act akin to manufacture. Now, I think these concerns were very well expressed by a 2003 editorial in Christianity Today, and that's the quote you have here. Medical science has progressed to the point of offering us many ways to bring a child into the world, whether using our own bodies or those of complete strangers. But what threats might this Promethean offer pose to our very souls? Or just as important, to the bodies and the souls created in vitro, end of quote. I think the implication here is that this expression of medical science by its very nature is a threat to what we are as human beings standing before God. It is therefore to be approached with great caution. Now, on this view, it's not IVF in specific terms that is being condemned. Its very nature as a technological procedure is seen as being antithetical to what human life is all about. And so, by definition, the natural is superior to the artificial and the technological. And from a Christian angle, the latter should be looked upon with deep suspicion. As we move to category D, this is what I call child and family-centered. And here we're looking at infertility. So with this category, then, we leave approaches based predominantly on protection of embryos to those that take far greater account of the needs of the infertile. There may still, of course, be concerns to protect embryos, but these are to be weighed against the needs of those longing for a child of their own. There's recognition here that science and technology can bring about good ends in the lives of human individuals and families. But if these are to be achieved, they will have to be balanced against the undeniable negatives that can result from excessive dependence upon technology and an unwillingness to accept its limits. And so in seeking balance, limits will be placed on research and clinical conduct, including boundaries imposed, I think, by the marriage bond, as well as the extent of what would be done to embryos. And I think from this, it follows then that any approval of IVF within a Christian framework is not equivalent to approving its unfettered use. It recognizes that human beings are moral beings who confront moral choices, both for themselves and others. And so they have to weigh up the advantages and the drawbacks of utilizing embryos for good purposes, as well as the blessings and the challenges faced by those who use IVF within the circle of their families. Category E. This is what I call desire-centered. This is very much getting us into the realm of technological imperialism. I think it's become very evident in the years between 1978 and the present day that IVF has been employed far more extensively than previously imagined. The days of helping young married couples have children of their own in the face of infertility problems, they have been largely overtaken. Of course, this still occurs, but it now represents just one group of recipients. The social trends include single people, same-sex couples, older postmenopausal women, and those in different generations of the same family, all of them resorting to IVF. However, IVF is no more than one component within the litany of changes, as of course has been exactly the same case with oral contraceptives. Now, these trends will fulfill the doomsday scenarios foretold by opponents of IVF from the 1960s onwards, because for them, IVF is technology out of control. Instead of healing people medically, it takes on the facade of technological imperialism with its ability to create in previously unimagined ways. And so the fear of the slippery slope has come to haunt one society after another, as IVF as helper has become IVF creator of unusual and sometimes even aberrant family structures. Now, I think it's easy to paint a gloomy scenario like this, a direction I think which is taken by many Christian commentators. But I think care has to be exercised that we don't exaggerate unduly. Family structures have been and continue to be challenged by, of course, as we know, many moral and social factors. And of those, IVF is just one. The way in which a technology is applied depends upon human decision-making, and it's this that has to be analyzed and critiqued. I think a Christian perspective is poignantly aware of human limitations, as well as of the human proclivity to misuse and to misdirect even the most spectacular of human achievements. And I think that's why any Christian approval of IVF will be a circumspect approval and have little in common with those who wish to use it hubristically. But I think we have to face up to a question. Is my category D morphing into E? As one views the five categories, it's not difficult to see why Christian commentators espouse embryo-centered approaches, because these appear to provide a bulwark against runaway technology that, in the case of IVF, may be commandeered to change our horizons about what constitutes human nature. So the question is, what do we make of this? Well, the first point I want to make is to acknowledge that recent developments in the ARTs appear to diminish the gap between categories D and E, that is, the child and family-centered category and the technological imperialist category. And these range, though, from the routine to the highly experimental. The routine group consists of procedures that are also found in clinical practice outside the reproductive technologies. And these include things like the use of gamete donations, sperm and egg donor banks, and surrogate pregnancies. Now, this doesn't justify any of these ethically or theologically, but they are essential in overcoming infertility in some cases, and I think they should fit into category D. I think the move into E begins to occur when PGD is used for the detection of late-onset genetic disorders, such as breast cancer, that will probably develop in the late 30s or so. And I think it moves further towards E with sex selection for social reasons, three-parent IVF children to overcome mitochondrial disorders, and the example that I gave right at the beginning, next-generation sequencing to check the embryos for abnormal chromosomes. It doesn't say that any of these is right or wrong, but I think it's beginning to at least place them in what I see as hopefully helpful categories. A second point I want to acknowledge is the expansive vistas of those who wish to use biomedical technology as a way of introducing their vision of a post-human future, a future brought into existence by human beings without any recourse to God or any religious sensibilities. And this, of course, gets us into one aspect of the world of transhumanism, and it's unequivocal category E category territory. And the bulk of this, of course, is highly speculative. The vistas owe more to idealistic visions of what humans could become than to the realistic demands of reproductive science. And many of these are explicitly anti-Christian. My third point here, the third dimension, I think, is the negativity regularly expressed by theological commentators. Now, I do have some sympathy with these commentators when confronted by the more extreme post-human speculations. But this is far removed from the daily experience of IVF. My conclusion is that far greater attention needs to be devoted by theologians to the ethical and the spiritual challenges of those who have infertility problems and who wish to have a child of their own within a Christian context. Because I think if we fail at this point, then we leave Christian couples who have infertility problems in a theological and an ethical wasteland. And so, let's try and assess this. The driving impetus, it seems to me, is to ask, what might be most pleasing to God? Now, that question might sound very vacuous, but it's to drive us to the centrality of Christ and to biblical directives with their emphasis upon humility, an ethic of responsibility, and stewardship of God's creation. They will never provide us with easy, ready-made answers, but they'll force us to justify what we are aiming to do and why we wish to utilize these procedures. And central, I think, to decision-making will be the welfare of families, family relationships, the importance of individuals, and particularly the resulting children, and we will place considerable emphasis on the significance of marriage. All these, I think, are central to Christian life and society because it's a human-centered framework as opposed to one driven by technological control. A human-centered framework focuses on the significance of humans in the eyes of God as his beings and for Christians as his people. And so whatever limits are imposed will flow from this framework. And so finally, scientific contributions in the reproductive area have been immense, both, I think, at the fundamental and the applied levels. And it seems to me that Christians should be more open about the blessings of these investigations in spite of distressing misdirections by those intent on remodeling humanity according to their own specifications. IVF is never a panacea for anyone, and it'll be accompanied by myriad demands upon anyone involved. And there are, of course, many unknowns. Christians, like others, are to balance these pluses and these minuses. They're to utilize elements in IVF that are helpful in bringing full-orbed health to individuals and families, and they're to reject excesses that are counterproductive to family life. So what I suggest is that Christian approval of the ARTs, if it is going to be an approval, will be a circumspect approval. and it'll seek to grapple with questions of motivation, limits on ways in which the ARTs will be employed, the centrality of human relationships for decision making, and the role of legitimate scientific investigation in understanding early human development. This is what it seems to me Christian ethical decision making is all about. And it also points to how Christians are to function within the public square. Thank you very much.